So, let's start with the general idea of the Big Bang. So, we think the universe is about 15 billion years old. And at the beginning, wait, let me, how do I, yeah, is that about it? Oh, I could even sit down and give this talk. Oh, that's good. You want it higher? Okay, so we start with a soup of hot quarks and leptons, and the universe cools off and expands, so that eventually, out of the soup, you can make the particles that we know, namely hadrons and mesons. That happens at a temperature of about 100 MeV. And of course, as time goes on, you continue to condense objects and make galaxies. Yes. Yes. Not anymore. Well, it depends. The assumption is that very early on, this picture of quarks and leptons, you can talk about them as interacting with each other constantly, so that you do have thermal equilibrium. And then eventually, one by one, the particles tend to drop out of equilibrium as the universe expands, and their reaction rates become slower than the expansion rate. So then they fall out of equilibrium. But that's why, that's why we're able to calculate a lot of things, because you just do assume thermal equilibrium, and actually you get the right answer. I guess one of the things that's remarkable is making these assumptions, you can extrapolate back to, I'll show you a few minutes after the bang, and you get the right answer to remarkable accuracy. So this field is not in the realm of speculation anymore. It is a precision measurements that go way back, thanks to being able to make that assumption.
People said there was some phase transition as the thing expanded, right? Was it
probably several. Okay. How about you let me do the big picture first?
Okay. Right.
And then certainly, I mean, that's one of the. I was going to do big picture rather than.
Big picture.
Okay. Okay. So I also wanted to. What I was going to focus on is the fact that in the last 2 years, some of the big questions sort of that have been around since 1930 have been answered, and so these are experimental results. So what is the mass density of the universe? What is the geometry of the universe? And these are things that when I was in graduate school, that it wasn't clear we were going to know in my lifetime. So all of a sudden, boom, we have answers to some of these old questions, and we have a paradigm shift, new, you know, with weird things happening. But so people have misconceptions about the basic picture, so humor me. Let me go through this. So in this picture of the expanding universe, is the raisin, like a piece of raisin bread. These are supposed to be like individual galaxies. So all these things are moving apart from one another. There is no central point here. So when you're talking about a Big Bang, if you extrapolate backwards in time to where you would have an infinitely high density, that would be true at every point. So this bang happened everywhere at the same, supposedly at the same time, I guess. Not that we know what happened before that. But so the principles that were applied, you know, back in the 30s to Einstein's equations were assumptions that were made that the universe is homogeneous. In other words, it looks the same at every point. So again, there is no special point. It's isotropic, that if you look in different directions in the sky, that you see the same thing. And this is borne out by measurements in the microwave background. So these are assumptions that were made, and for those things were getting kind of interesting in the 80s, because as you went to larger scales, instead of finding homogeneity, you found bigger and bigger structures like this great wall. So these are huge structures. This is like 150 megaparsecs in size, this thing. Or so a parsec is... okay, so this is kilometers per second. So this is sort of like redshift as you're going out here. So the size of these things is supposed to be. Yeah, I'm not. So I shouldn't be showing data because I don't know enough about it. But these things are. So the thing that is relevant, the number that I know is 150 megaparsecs for the scale of this thing. So it's very. You know, this thing's supposed to be a wall. We're at the center. We're at the center, and this is looking out. So, yeah, this is the speed with which things are moving away from us. So you can convert the redshift to for low redshifts, the kilometers per second is the redshift, but this is not true here, right? So. Yeah. So these are big objects, but you see, I shouldn't be showing data that I can't answer these kind of questions on, but. This is where you supposed to start seeing homogeneity now. So this is 1,000 megaparsecs in scale. A factor of 10. So, well, I'm just saying that as you get to larger scales, people were worried, where is the homogeneity? And eventually you see it. Yeah. Yeah. This wasn't. That's what I'm saying. There was an assumption made from the beginning about what are you going to write down? What are you going to work with? The assumption was made that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic on large scales, and until recently, that wasn't even. The isotropy was verified a long time ago with the microwave background, but that you have the homogeneity is only fairly recent that you actually see this now. That as you look on large enough scales, that things average out.
If you average out over
a big enough scale, that it. Yeah, so people have played around with the idea, do you have that? Is the universe described by some kind of fractal or this and that? And it looks like that its homogeneity is okay. So that was the point. On very, very large scales only. Very, yes, very, very large scales. So we have bigger structures to make than we thought. But now, if you take this with these assumptions of homogeneity and isotropy applied to Einstein's equations, this is what they look, this is what you, what, this is the basic equation, the Friedman equation that we work with. So this on the left side, R, is the scale factor of the universe. So I know I'm blocking people no matter where I go. Well, yeah, but I know, but I have to get to my transparencies, and I'm going to trip over this. Well, that's not good for them. You guys, it doesn't help. It just. Move your chair. Can you move your chair? Where are they going? Yeah, but I'm right-handed, so I'm going to end up here anyway. Okay, so where are you going? Getting a chair? No, I don't want that. Anyway. Okay, so this is describing the expansion of the universe. This is the scale factor for the size. So it's as you expand this thing, this gets bigger. H, the Hubble constant, is defined to be R dot over R. And so what is it that's driving the expansion? On the right-hand side, whatever contributes to an energy density over here. So matter, which scales as 1 over R cubed. Radiation, 1 over R fourth, possibly a vacuum term, which I'll get back to. And then over here, these are possible curvatures for the universe. So I tried to draw two-dimensional analogs. Okay, so these were the three possibilities for the geometry. So hyperboloid, flat, or spherical. And this parameter omega, oh, thank you, So this parameter omega is the ratio of rho over rho critical, where if I set the second term equal to zero and solve for the energy density that I would plug in here, assuming that I know what H is, then I get this value, then I get rho C, and it's this number. It's not a constant in time. No. So I don't know why it's called a Hubble constant. So I don't know. So until a few years ago, we didn't know which of these geometries was right, and so we know that it's flat. Yes, the Hubble constant is Hubble constant's constant is a function of distance. So I guess when Hubble measured it, he measured as you look at different length scales, that yes, it's the slope of the speeds of things moving away from you as a function of distance to them, and he found a straight line, which I understand he originally faked the data to get the answer he wanted. But anyway, so. Again, I don't know how much you guys know about this, but this is the big result of the year 2000, that omega equals one, universe is flat. So that means you know what the energy density is, you know what the geometry is.
With some arrow bars, or?
Yeah, sure. About 10% at this point, or better.
Okay.
And
but people knew that before. People suspected that we're sort of flattish.
Well, there were theoretical arguments for it. If you draw if the time dependence of omega, if it's equal to one, it's always equal to one. If it deviates even by one part in 10 to the 60, then, for example, if we had a closed universe, the spherical universe reaches maximum expansion and recollapses, and then the natural time scale for that is a Planck time of 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay, so that's big puzzle as to if it's not equal to one, then the other values are extremely unstable, and you would never get a universe that's 10 billion years old. And in fact, the whole point of inflation, and inflationary cosmology, is to try to address this. It drives you to an omega of one. So a lot of people thought that there was the theoretical prejudice that omega equals one a long time ago. Okay, I'm going to show that. That comes from the microwave background. So again, I'm not supposed to assume that you know about the microwave background. So. At high temperatures, bigger than 3,000 Kelvin, in other words, when the universe was less than about a million years old, you have photons and electrons floating around. There's free electrons that the photons comp and scatter off of. So the universe is opaque. If you could go back to that time, we wouldn't see each other because any photon would interact a million times before it would get from one of us to the other. Because of these constant interactions, you're in thermal equilibrium. The photons have a Planck spectrum, and you see that. What happens is that there's a change at 3,000 Kelvin, which is that the electrons disappear. So they make hydrogen. They get together with the protons and make hydrogen, and there's no longer enough energy in the universe to dissociate the hydrogen. So before that, the reaction goes both ways. Now the photons have nothing to stop them, and universe becomes transparent, and this Planck spectrum that you had during this hot thermal phase continues with the photons cooling off, and we see them. That's the microwave background. And their temperature today is 2.7 degrees Kelvin. And this is from the COBE satellite. The universe expands. So they just redshift with the expansion. You assume an adiabatic expansion with the temperature dropping as 1 over the scale factor. Uh-oh. Um, it's the Boltzmann equation. So it's in an exponent. So e to the minus.
Right.
So certainly the binding energy is in there. So it's
sure,
it's.
But that's the binding energy of the ground state.
No. That's
the ionization energy.
No. I mean, if you do the Boltzmann equation, you calculate the number density. It's just the Saha equation, which is the number density of the things on the left-hand side equals the number density of things on the right-hand side times this Boltzmann factor. And so if you solve this, So the COBE satellite was in the 80s, was actually the first one to really verify that you get this black body. And in fact, in the first 10 minutes of data, they had the best black body spectrum, better than in any lab on Earth. So this is confirmation that people had played around with alternatives to a hot Big Bang, but it's very hard to get something this beautiful without having had some hot early phase. So I think people are not talking about hot Big Bang model anymore. It's just the hot Big Bang was right. I mean, it's not complete, but there are elements of it that are certainly true. No. That just proves it's hot. Okay, so how do you get omega out of this? Before this time of last scattering, before this recombination, you have the photons and the baryons tied together, and they have acoustic oscillations. And there's a length scale imprinted on the last time that they oscillate, which is the size of the sound horizon at last scattering. So how far does sound travel at that time? Well, that gives you a length scale, which amounts to an angle of 1 degree times omega to the 1/2 power. So the volume of the universe is different depending on what the energy density is. So the size of the sound horizon is different. So you're going to see a peak in the spectrum at this angular scale. And it's an L of 200.
So when you say acoustic oscillation, what's the medium which is carrying those oscillations?
It's the photons and baryons. Okay, so we put ourselves at the center of the sphere and decompose the microwave background in terms of spherical harmonics. Okay, so the temperature differences at different angular scales. This coefficient here, the CLs, are the things that you can predict and go and measure. So I mean, this is quite an indirect way of trying to get at an energy density, but it works. So here were these were the predictions beforehand of these CLs as a function of L, and for an omega equals 1, you expected a peak at 1 degree, which is an L of 200. Okay, and so it's pretty much independent of other parameters, which is not completely true, of course, but remarkably so. So that's the thing that was the thing that people were trying to get, was where's the location of this peak. And the first group to do it was Boomerang, which used they went to the South Pole and flew a balloon for 10.5 days. They were lucky. They got a really good flight. Okay, there's their path around the South Pole. And what? No, no, no. Why? Why do they go to the pole? It's dry down there, so you can get a nice clean unobstructed flight down there that you can't get anywhere else. This you don't have problems with winds or water. Yeah. It's dry. Yeah. Yeah, that's the key. Okay, and so this is a computer reconstruction of what they saw. There's the balloon about to be launched. And if you had a 35 millimeter camera in the microwave, this is what you'd see. So I like this picture. What they saw, hot spots and cold spots.
Those are the oscillations due to the last oscillation.
Yes. Yep. Ten to the five, one part in 10^5. Amazing, amazing. So in order to this idea of gravitational instability picture of galaxy formation, that if you start, you know, have a homogeneous universe, something imprints some density fluctuation, this fluctuation grows, and if that's true, then it should affect the photons, and you should see this delta T in the microwave background. The initial calculations were it should be at 10^-3. And that was, when was it that that was, it wasn't seen at 10^-3, wasn't seen at 10^-4. People started getting worried. The theorists adapt, but you can't keep adapting, right? And so you're sort of wondering about the whole Big Bang at this point, because how else are you going to make structure if not with gravity? So then COBE actually found it in the 80s. They found it at 10^-5. So finding it at all was really critical to the whole field. But then going and measuring it on particular angular scales, getting the accuracy that you need to do this kind of cosmology. I mean, this is really precision cosmology, where you're going to, in the goal in the end is to measure all the parameters to great accuracy. Now, I'm advertising, this is too much because, in fact, there's 12 parameters that go into, that you adjust and so on. So trying to get all 12 of them out of there is, but, I mean, what you can do is remarkable. So, so comparing with COBE, where this with the boomerang, if you I don't know if you can see, you take a tiny piece of the COBE and blow it up, so the resolution's a lot better now. And I'm sorry, this seems to be the only plot I have of this, which is pretty. It's a good thing none of the microwave background people are here. But so this was the original boomerang result. So that this peak, there's no doubt about it. This is a peak at an LF 200. At that point, with a 10% accuracy. And as I said, you get the harmonics also. So you see a number of peaks, and at this point, the second peak has been seen, the third, and in the long run, if you find all these guys, and you also find the polarization and so on, the amount of information you get out is amazing. But so from sort of big picture point of view, the thing that I wanted to say is the discovery that the geometry is flat, that omega equals one, we know the energy density. I also wanted to say this is in agreement with inflation, doesn't prove it. So I was going to just quickly review the idea of inflation. So the goal is to explain why the universe is homogeneous and isotropic on large scales, even though that is an apparent violation of causality. Okay. And inflation does predict a flat universe. Also, one of the very important things that it does, it gives you an explanation for the starting point of the density fluctuations, which we really don't have any other explanation for.
But the proof that omega equals 1 is very model dependent, right? Because what you really measure is an isotropy in the fluctuations in temperature,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying there's some model which depends on omega, and if omega wasn't equal to 1, the peak wouldn't be there.
Right, yeah.
It's not a direct measurement.
Well, no,
okay.
But it's. No, what model is it relying on?
Well, you have some model which connects.
Well, it relies on the Friedman equation, but I mean there's it relies on it relies on the general Big Bang picture, which is right. Yeah, but I mean there's a completely consistent picture at this point. And it doesn't rely on any of the other parameters. It doesn't rely on...
Those are basic hydrodynamic arguments. You just put some density fluctuations to Friedman equation, and then you see what...
Yeah, that's it. That's all there is. It's very simple. So no one disbelieves it. Absolutely no one. I mean, if you want to throw away the entire Big Bang, yeah, you know, okay, feel free, but it's really, it's very simple. Yeah. Let me just run through what inflation, how inflation is supposed to work. So you have an early period, which is vacuum dominated, so that on the right-hand side of this equation, well, this is constant, so the solution is exponential growth of the scale factor. It doesn't have to be exponential, but it has to be faster than, it has to be superluminal, so faster than t. So that you take some small region, which is smooth, it's small enough that it had plenty of time to thermalize or whatever, and that's actually non-trivial too, but anyway, so you take some small smooth region and blow it up. And then our universe, the part that we see, lies inside here. So you can explain why the different regions in the sky, if you look 180 degrees apart, how can the microwave background have the same temperature to 1 part in 10 to the 5? That's actually a causal if you extrapolate back. Those two regions ordinarily wouldn't have had time to communicate, but in this picture they do. So that's the basic idea of inflation, and then you can talk about where do you get such a thing, and such a vacuum energy, and this is people try potentials for various fields and so on, and this is a business of trying to construct models that give you this.
Also, you need to explain why there's superluminal expansion, right? Because
well, that's the point. If you have a constant here, you will have a superluminal expansion. So if you have some very flat potential that you're rolling down, you will get something, maybe not exponential, but it's fast. Unfortunately, this is a potential for some field that's very massive, you know, 10 to the 12 GeV or something, so you can't go look for this anywhere. No. It's not something that is in particle physics for any other reason. That's just the trouble. It has to be postulated explicitly to solve these problems, and it's hard to get these flat potentials. It's typically unnatural. You can do it. No. Is there chalk here? Okay, I just don't want it to trip. So let's postulate some scalar field. Okay, so when I say flat, I mean that this thing, that the ratio of the height to the width to the fourth power, that has to be a small number. So you assume that you start here somewhere and slowly roll down, and while you're, this is the vacuum energy then, this energy difference between the final, where you're going to end up, and where the universe has to be sitting here with this vacuum domination for a long time. So you have to construct this potential to be very flat. And the equation of motion as you're rolling down, something like that. And so unfortunately, I mean, this is unknowns, yeah, unknown field. It doesn't have to be scalar, which is just is easier to work with. And worse than that, this is typically, this ratio of scales is like if you have a lambda 5/4, well, that ratio is lambda. Why should that ratio lambda be 10 to the minus 12? You have to have some, so you have to work pretty hard to get this thing to work. But the reason people are happy, the reason people believe it is because it's the only way we know to drive you towards a smooth universe and a flat one. It drives you towards an omega of 1. And it also solves the monopole problem. If you have a grand unified phase transition, if you have anything, if you start with some grand unified theory and then you end up with electromagnetism embedded inside it, you, by definition, it's mathematics, you get monopoles out. And the number that you should get out, you should get 1 per horizon volume, typically, which would give you an omega in monopoles of 10 to the 12. So that's the monopole problem. And in fact, Alan Guther originally proposed inflation to solve that problem. So by blowing up the space-time so that you end up with 1 monopole in this huge region now. so that you can actually live with the results of, you know, having electromagnetism left behind. And then, so he was just trying to solve the monopole problem, and then he noticed, hey, I'm solving some other problems. I guess I should mention that on the, Gabby was asking about the topological defects that you, well, about yeah. phase transitions. So what can you get? You can get the monopoles you have to get rid of. You can also get domain walls and cosmic strings. And people, this business of cosmic strings was in fact a field for a long time, which had the possibility of generating perturbations for structure formation. So people were interested in that. However, the predictions for what you would see in the microwave background are come out wrong. So the power spectrum that you would expect and so on, it isn't right. So cosmic strings are ruled out as far as making structure. So the only thing left is inflation. And the way it works with inflation is you start with quantum fluctuations in this field. And these quantum fluctuations end up becoming classical and start the whole picture of galaxy formation. There is no alternative at the moment. That's another reason that people are very eager for inflation to be right. No. Domain walls are a big problem because they would give you an anisotropy that you would see, again, in the microwave background and so on. It's possible to make some later on, late-time domain walls that they're on, how does that work, on smaller scales or something? I don't know why you can get away with that. But so topological defects are not in favor for doing anything good for cosmology anymore. Yeah, well, not no. the one thing I can tell you, other than there are things that you can go after, which is that in the future with the microwave background experiments, you're going to get the polarization, and depending on so you'll be able to differentiate between inflationary models. You'll be able to throw a lot of them out. So depending on the shape of this potential, you're going to predict different ratios of different amounts of gravitational modes in addition to the density perturbations. And these gravitational wave modes, well, they should also show up. So you can throw out models, but you can't prove them, no. And,
What was that that just disappeared?
Oh, just that this is what I was, exactly what I just said, that the future, you'll be able to differentiate between models, but that doesn't mean you can prove it.
So you measure the temperature and isotropy more precisely, or what will the
polarization will give you the information also about these tensor modes.
Oh, I see. So we're going to measure the polarization of the
Microwave background.
Of microwave background.
Yep. I'm not sure.
Polarization,
what?
Fluctuations in the polarization. You don't expect the light to be polarized.
They. This is the details of. Of this, of like last scattering and so on, so you actually get again peaks in the.
Yeah,
it's a similar thing. Pretty amazing. And so I just wanted to say that right now MAP is taking data. Our conference was supposed to coincide with the result of their release of their data. They are going to release as soon as we're done. They're late. Yeah, well, they're late. How do you time that properly? 3 years in advance, you know. And then the other big experiment, these are satellites, and the other big one is Planck, which is a European effort. And this is going to be launched in 2007. Yeah, so these are, now we're getting up to where you've got, well, this, I mean, we didn't expect. So these, we're now up to where there's hundreds of people working on these things. So this is a field that is becoming more like high energy physics in that sense. Okay, so, all right, so you know that omega equals 1, and you think you know the energy density of the universe, but you still don't know what it is. We don't know the pieces of this. Maybe I should just write down out of this. So omega total is 1. Omega baryon is about 5% of that. So neutrons and protons and so on, I'll show you why we think that, or why we know that. And then the best guess is that omega dark matter is about 0.3, And then, so there's, you're still missing 0.7, okay? Okay, I'm going to talk about that. So let me first tell you why the ordinary stuff is only 5% of the total. So I was going to tell you how we know that first. You know that from primordial nucleosynthesis, which is something that happened at about 3 minutes after the bang. There's a book by Steven Weinberg called The First 3 Minutes, which is pretty good, a little paperback. And so at that time, you have deuterium becoming stable. So at temperatures higher than 10 to the 10 Kelvin, you have this reaction going in both directions. Every time you make deuterium, it falls apart. And again, it's this Saha equation kinds of arguments. And now deuterium becomes stable. And once it does, you can make a few other things. Deuterium, helium-3, helium-4, lithium-7. Those are the things you make. That's all you make in the Big Bang. 25%, in fact, the predictions down here, it's 25% is helium-4, 10 to the minus 4 deuterium, 10 to the minus 10 lithium-7. And if you want to make anything heavier, you have to wait for stars. You have to have triple alpha in stars where you have three heliums get together to make carbon. So this is, it's rather, I remember the first time I heard about this, I thought it must be science fiction, because it's like a one-line argument why you expect 25% helium. And so over all these 10 orders of magnitude that these measurements turn out to be right is sort of a remarkable prediction. So this is, again, this is a picture of the helium-4 deuterium lithium-7 that you expect. This yellow band is where you match the data. And what this axis is megabaryon. So what fraction is in neutrons and protons and so on. And that's where that's where I get this number 5%. And this is known to much better accuracy than this. This part is probably old. But this is just to give you the idea of how it's done. The megabaryon is also something you can get out of the microwave background. It's the height of the second peak, also is determined by a megabaryon. It's another way to go after it. Okay, so omega totals 1. Neutrons and protons are 5%. Yes.
Yes.
Are you talking about from the baryon? It doesn't have to do. The only thing that's very model, that's completely model independent, is omega total. All of the rest of these, you're going to have to. The omega baryon affects. The role it plays is when does dark matter, it's which piece of the universe dominates at what time in the energy in the history of the universe and so on. It actually has nothing to do with nucleosynthesis as far as in the height. So it affects the recombination. But you're right that you start having to. You have a lot of pieces of data, and you have also a lot of inputs, and you have to pull them apart. And they put priors in, and when they quote constraints on omega baryon, they have to put priors in. They put in a prior on what the Hubble constant is. But that's okay, because we know it pretty well. So you put priors in on some of these parameters in order to get the other ones out. So it's reasonable what they're doing. But other than omega total, there's definitely some, it's a game at this point. Okay, so the dark matter problem. 90% of the mass in galaxies is unknown. And this is true for our own galaxy as well. Every galaxy, including ours. So I'm claiming up here that the 30% of the total is matter, but it's not baryons. But how do we know that it even exists? We know from, if we look at rotation curves of galaxies, so if this is the center of the galaxy, then you move out a distance r from the center, and you watch how fast something moves. And from the speed of this thing, you can figure out how much mass has to be interior to it. Okay? So the velocity inside this radius r is determined by the mass inside that radius. So by simple analogy, I'll put up the solar system. Maybe I shouldn't throw in a caveat to begin with, but the reason that they found Neptune is because they saw Uranus was moving in some weird way they didn't understand, and so they postulated Neptune, and they were right. Of course, then they saw Mercury doing weird things, and they postulated Vulcan, but it was GR. So I'm already throwing this as a caveat, that we think from following these, by plotting V of R, that we think we're finding dark matter, but are we in fact finding something else weird? I don't know. But anyway, so... what the heck? She's the first person to notice this, the dark matter problem. So Vera Rubin. So here's what was expected. So you plot these velocities as you move out from the center, and this is what people were sure you were going to see, because you know how many stars there are and so on, and so you figure out how the velocity should be dropping. But that's not what they saw. Instead, the velocity is constant for a long ways out. So there's more matter in there than you understand. Okay? In fact, 95% of it. At the center you've got you think of this as being the galaxy as being a spherical object.
Yeah.
And it has a disk in the middle. And so as you're first moving out, you're seeing you're seeing the disk and so on. And as you move out, you start picking up more and more of this stuff. There certainly is dark matter in the middle too.
What's the question? I mean, you get, if I remember correctly, what they learned, you get a profile of dark matter distribution.
Yeah. This part out here, the best, if for flat, is like 1/r².
Right. So this profile, I mean, stars through gravity, but is this a stable profile? Just, you know, that distribution of dark matter also is caused probably only by gravity. So is this, you know, if you just write down the equation, is this a stable solution?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, Peebles was saying that there has to be a halo for the galaxy, because otherwise these bars and so on, with the galaxy falls apart. So you want to stabilize it. You have to have he was already saying you need some spherical object out there. So I'm not sure if that's what you're asking. Well, this is a whole field of people who do galaxy formation. So they start with some dark matter particles, and they simulate as these things fall in, and you make small structures first. It's a hierarchical formation of stellar kind of objects, and they group together. And the best guess at the moment for what you end up with is actually quite a steep profile in the middle. Let me show that also. I can show a picture of that. This is a very rich cluster. And okay, so there's 100 galaxies in this thing. This is done by lensing and with using space telescope. And so there's dark matter in between the galaxies also, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, that's a good question.
So that's the dark matter.
This is the dark matter. Isn't that cool? I love it. I think this is such a cool picture.
Yeah.
This is data. Okay. This is data, but. Well, let me stick. I mean, in the individual galaxies, they have, it's like you have isothermal spheres is a model, it's a simple model that would be a stable thing. And I mean, that's not exactly what they get, but yeah, these things are stable.
The question I'd like to ask, I think, is you take that from an experiment,
uh-huh.
And now you do a simulation of the rest of the matter in the presence of this in the background, you get what you see.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean the rest of the matter? This is the matter.
Well,
look, most clusters are not yet virialized, okay? This is an exceptional object, this rich one right here. So most of them are still forming. They're still settling down. And then also galaxies inside them, they hit each other and they merge and so on. So these are pretty sophisticated objects. So I don't, for clusters, things have not settled down, but individual galaxies have. And they're stable, yeah. Well, nobody knows. Let me get to that. Yeah, if you get that, you'll get a couple of Nobel Prizes. Well, I'm going to say about that. Well, this is where I'm going. Hold on one second. Let me just show that this is, in the simulations, this is what people think the very large structures look like. So you have filaments of stuff. Yeah, but you can go on even larger scales then and then smooth it out. Yeah. I don't know. You guys. There's this guy, Pietro Nero, who argues for a fractal and